Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. So I wanted to maybe start with giving you a little bit of time to drill in a little bit more about how you think about the sweet spot concept related to microdosing specifically. I think we mostly talked about in the past LSD and psilocybin. I want to just set the floor for you to give any wisdom or advice on the research that you've had to continue that notation and take it from there.
Wonderful. And remind me, but there's actual hard-nosed, the kind of research I usually say not nice things about, exactly about the sweet spot.
Mm.
Much Perfect. To my surprise.
Mm.
So let's see the clip and let's see what I used to say.
Well, I think the clip I'm going to probably put in the show notes, and I would just love to have you, in whatever way you think about a sweet spot, maybe add anything or reiterate where your thinking goes as it relates to finding a sweet spot, how somebody can think about going about finding that for themselves, because there's obviously a massive appetite for people that came across our conversation to learn from you about how they might think about approaching finding a sweet spot in the first place.
Okay, let's go back a step. We're talking about microdoses.
Yeah.
And since microdoses, you take them every few days over a period of weeks or even months, you want to find what's the ideal dose for you, what we call the sweet spot. Now, what's too low a dose? No effects.
Hmm.
What's too high a dose? And this is important because this is where people make their error, which is they say, well, I'd like just a dose where I kind of know I'm on a psychedelic. And the answer is that's too high.
Hmm.
What you want is a dose where you're getting the benefits that you intend and that you're not especially aware of any what we would call classic psychedelic effects. There's the colors are not brighter, maybe a tiny bit. The flowers do not turn and look at you. They may just nod a bit. But what you do notice is that you're feeling better, you're feeling kinder, you're eating better, your sleeping habits have changed, and one of a number of conditions, in most cases, you're finding some improvement. That's the sweet spot. Now, that's a kind of personal, and that's the way you go through life. You know, how much ice cream do you have? Well, I have a sweet spot, which I normally have a scoop, but sometimes, you know, when it's a really hot day, I'll have two scoops. And sometimes if I've already eaten a lot, I'll just take somebody, you know, just give me a taste. So mm-hmm. We know that our own individual taste varies. Now, what is remarkable, and this is research by Connor Murray, a PhD at UCLA drug studies, where certain benefits of microdosing, particularly cognitive improvement, go up as dose goes up into the microdose range, 10, 12, 13 micrograms of LSD, for example. Hmm. And then when it goes up again, as high as 26 micrograms, where people are beginning to say, oh, yeah, I know I'm not the placebo, the effect goes away.
Hmm.
And the cognitive enhancement diminishes again. So for the first time, because nobody's ever looked that way, which is what's the effect of changing doses? And the answer is there's a sweet area in where maximum benefits seem to be measurable. And above that, you get into the kind of cheerful disorganization that a higher dose has. And what we know about a higher dose is your interest in things like getting your work done diminishes because you know that your work has no real value in the world and never will. Or that it's really so important, but you can't get to it today because you'd rather notice how your breathing is and how the hairs in your nose move when you breathe. We're talking about kind of low dose psychedelic effects. Those actually interfere with the basic physiological and mental improvements that seem to be at the core of effective microdosing.
Hmm.
So again, it's The only person who can dose you correctly is you. Hmm. Remember, when you go to the pharmacy and you've had a prescription for something and it comes in three sizes, that's an attempt from the manufacturer to make it so that there's a high, medium, and low. But we're much more subtle than that as human beings. And your sweet spot can change. Hmm. When you're under high stress, it may be more or less. When you're feeling as if, what's the point of microdosing? My life is working just fine. Then it also may change. So it's not, again, a set spot. Hmm. It is literally, when using a food analogy, when someone says to you, here is a platter of something, you know, salmon, asparagus, pie, how much should I give you? Okay, there's an inner part of you that has an answer to that, and it's not the same every time. So the sweet spot is your sweet spot, not the sweet spot. Okay?
Very good. And I would love if you can to give, I know you were giving, I think, quantities for an LSD microdose there, but for psilocybin weights as well, and this is mostly for people who are probably just getting familiar with your work, what kind of quantities are we talking about there?
For most people, and I'll clarify what the other group is, but for most people, the range is between a tenth of a gram of a cubensis mushroom, the kind of most ordinary, most usual psychedelic mushroom, because it's easiest to grow, to about 4/10 of a gram. Hmm. And over the 10 or 12 years I've been working with this, we keep dropping this number down as more and more people say, you know, half a gram, 0.5, that's too much. Hmm. Now we also have, this is, remember, that was most people within that range, 0.1 to 0.5 or 0.4. What about people that say, well, I took a tenth of a gram and it blew me out of the water. It was much too much. And I remember a dialogue on Reddit. There's a Reddit wonderful site called Microdosing. Hmm. 250,000 people on it. And you can get any, if you ask a question, you get 35 answers from people that know more than you do. It's wonderful. And the question someone asks is, well, I'm taking not a tenth of a gram, but a hundredth of a gram, and I'm still getting all the results I wanted. Am I crazy? Hmm. And the answers were, oh, you and you and you. Yeah, we all have that. We're all what we call very sensitive. And what we found is Fatiman's suggestion of a tenth of a gram, it's way too much. So we don't really know how small a microdose can be, but we do know that there's a certain group of people who simply need much less. Now, let's go to the other end. When we were some years ago, Sophia Korb and I were basically saying to people, if you would like to know how to microdose, we'll give you suggestions, and in return, you'll tell us what happened. So we got hundreds and hundreds of reports from, as it worked out, about 51 countries. And one of the things we found is some people said, hey, man, I'm taking half a gram and nothing is happening. What's going on? And then they would write back and say, hey, man, at a gram and a half, I'm having the same effects that you've been describing. Hmm. What's going on? And what we found is there's a certain group of people who, and they're not very often, who get microdose effects at a much higher dose. They are almost all what we would call high-functioning autism. There's something about that particular other way of the brain working. It's not less, not more, simply a different way, which their need for psychedelics is different than, for microdosing is different than other people. So 0.1 to 0.4 for most of us, if 0.1 is too much, go down. If 0.4, now remember, when I say go above 4, that's only if you're having no effects. Yeah. It is not so you can sneakily say, well, I'm just taking a more because I really want to have the sense of being just a little high. The thing that goes wrong for people, doesn't go wrong for people with no experience, but people who are psychonauts very often really are assuming that a microdose is like a little tiny high dose. And it's not. It's really like switching between the AM and the FM dial. It's really different. And you will lose the benefits of microdosing by going too high. Hmm.
And I know you went into some detail at the beginning of this conversation about some of the benefits that people might experience from dabbling in these waters. And I want to give a little bit more time and space for you to articulate some of the benefits that you've seen in your career that people have reported upon. And I should preface this by saying, and you said this in our first conversation, that, you know, my understanding of your view on this is if you are concerned about this, if you have fear about this, if this does not feel comfortable for you or something that you don't feel called to do, don't do it. I'm assuming that's probably still your view on most of this.
That's the, you know, the same thing I say to my friends who want to skydive. Because for most people that skydive, it's not a problem. For a few people, it doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
Microdosing is not an experience. It's a invigorating of the entire physical mental system. So the question of what it's good for is very different from the high-dose world. The high-dose world is about breakthrough experience of inner and outer transcendence, seeing that all are one, that there's only love, or lower down, it's incredibly valuable psychotherapeutically, and so forth. Microdosing is, it's really what we're seeing is it rebalances the imbalances in your physical mental system. So that when I said before in one of my examples of kind of dose, people sleep better. Now, this is the wonderful part of that. That's for people who haven't taken it for sleep. People change their diets towards healthy. They haven't intended to do that. And that's when you're doing research, you are always a little suspicious of that you're jiggling the experiment or the way you want people to report it and so forth. So it meets your expectations. But when you get things that you didn't expect and that your people don't expect, that's a much more important piece of data. Mm-hmm. And so microdosing has very wide sweeping effects, both in the areas where people are already fine. This is kind of higher functioning or enhanced performance, and in areas where they have problems. Let me give you an example. This is... this is something from this morning so that you know that it's very fresh. I had a call from a remarkable coach, and he was talking about a report of somebody whose child, not her child, had been microdosing. Now, this is a child who is an older teenager with autism. And what the woman said is whenever this person comes over to her house, and I gather she and the other mother are good friends, the young man is agitated, irritated, everything's wrong, everything's too loud, the food's terrible. It's very unpleasant for him to be in really a new space. Hmm. And they have to kind of find a very quiet corner where he'll be okay. Since microdosing, all of that I just described to you has gone away. He doesn't complain about the food. He doesn't think things are too loud. He doesn't need to kind of be specially treated. And what came out of it is that the woman with the report said, because of what I've seen in this young man, I'm very interested in microdosing. Now, she's not interested in microdosing because she's autistic. She's just aware that the shift in his capacity to function well had vastly improved. Was he still autistic? I'm sure he was. But was he more comfortable in his own body? And was he more comfortable being in the world? Absolutely. And as a parent, you know, that's the kind of stuff makes you cry. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about. That's the difficulty side. Other people who say, one of my favorites is a martial arts, really a very serious martial artist with jiu-jitsu. And his comment, this was to a newspaper article, what's the difference now in your martial arts from now and from before you microdose to now when you do microdose? He said, well, I used to get silvers. Now I get golds. Hmm. So what he was saying is his same art. He doesn't have any, you know, no psychotherapeutic breakthroughs. But what he did as a highly developed physical person was better. And that's quite common. And a lot of people, we have some wonderful sports stories about other sports, but that one is about the cleanest.
What is your takeaway from all of your years of having conversations like that and looking at the data? of what is happening to people under the influence of some form of a microdosing protocol. What is, as best you understand it, how can you explain what's going on in people's minds and in their experience of being a human being in those contexts?
Well, I'm very light on theory. Yeah. Theory is actually a very classy word for guess. And what I've seen, the problem with theory is once you have one, you defend it.
Yeah.
And you start not seeing parts of the data. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's some physiological theories about how psychedelics work, and they're probably not true. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going there. Mm-hmm. What we seem to see, and I've kind of already mentioned it, is your system has, I don't know, 1,000 different subsystems. You have in your gut, you know, a couple of billion viruses and bacteria all working out their destiny on every moment. And they affect your mental condition. We now know, very recent data, that the brain, which was supposed to be free of all their little things, has perhaps 100,000 species of bacteria and virus. Okay, so you're a very big living system, very, very complicated, and you're not the only player. You're the kind of basket for a whole lot of other species. Well, what microdosing seems to do is make the basket function as well as it can. That means it's a very general comment, which is we have people reporting improvements in multiple sclerosis. We have people reporting improvements in algebra. Okay, that's a big sweep. How can that be from the same single source? And the answer is, if you think of it as a pharmaceutical, you're going to get crazy very soon. If you think of it as a nutrient, you're getting closer. If you think of it as a vitamin, you're also getting closer, because we assume what vitamins do is improve the system. You know, when you take vitamin D, it doesn't go to the D receptor in some part of your brain and never go anywhere else. That's ridiculous. It's microdose. And again, we find in any indigenous people that had availability of psychedelics seem to have used them mostly for health and healing. It's no different with the for us. So that's the comfortable thing is, and is that microdosing apparently helps your system. Now, what if you think that's, see, I can't, I've got to watch out, because I was about to say, what if you think that's not a good idea? But that's silly, because everyone thinks it's a good idea. What if you think that's either dangerous or illegal? One, it is predominantly illegal, and therefore you have to make your own decisions. You have to decide two things. One is obeying an unrealistically created law a good thing to do, or a necessary thing to do? And some people feel that is. Clearly, the 40 million people or so who've taken psychedelics since they became illegal didn't feel that way. So we are in a culture where the illegality is becoming less and less important. And now there's a whole generation, of course, that's grown up where it's always been illegal. It's always been available through their friends. And the laws are only going in one direction. They're getting more realistic. So we're dealing, you know, the question of what is its effect is it seems to notice, you know, when you go for a massage, either your masseuse says, where does it hurt? Or the masseuse after a few minutes says, it hurts here, doesn't it? Okay. So that in both senses, you're saying, I don't know what you, the masseuse, are going to do, but you'll find it. And I work with an acupuncturist, and it's even more clear that the energy systems through the body touch a whole, each one of the energy systems called meridians goes through a whole lot of different organs. And improvement is by making the current, the meridian, function correctly. And that's what microdoses do. They help the whole system function correctly.
Are there specific strands of psilocybin mushrooms that you think generally are better for gaining benefits from microdosing than others? Or would you say we don't really know, or they provide benefits in different ways, the different strands. What are your thoughts on that in general?
Basics understand that of the 200 species of mushroom, plus the variants that people are now creating, they all have psilocybin in them.
Yeah.
That's the active ingredient. Psilocybin, by the way, is not a psychedelic. It has no psychedelic effects, but in the body transforms it into psilocyne, which is an active psychedelic. That's just a little bit of science-y lore. Okay. Mushrooms have a different amount of psilocybin in them. Imagine as you go into a liquor store, they have a system where they don't make you guess. Down in the little small print, it says 26% alcohol, 13% alcohol, 52%. So you have some immediate notion of the differences. Mushrooms are not labeled, but species in general have higher or lower amounts of psilocybin. That's the basic. Then a little bit like wine tasters, we're beginning to get kind of subtle about what this species might do and what that species might do. And if you've ever bought cannabis at a dispensary and there's like 40 different varieties and you say, what's the difference? And he says, well, there's two types. Okay. And then it gets very subtle and it's hard to know how much of that is kind of made up by your bud tender. So the answer at this point is we don't have very clear indications of what the difference between species are. And remember, there are other alkaloids in the mushroom, and the balance of those alkaloids differs. And we know almost nothing about the other alkaloids, but we have a suspicion that the nature that created mushrooms and took maybe a billion years to work it all out didn't put those other alkaloids in there just to because they had empty spaces. So we really don't know much about the mix. Now, there's another problem if many of us are looking at the research. And the research says psilocybin lowers depression. These are all high-dose research, almost all. And then someone said, well, where's that psilocybin coming from? And they say it's synthetic. It's the exact same molecule that nature makes. And you say, well, nature doesn't make psilocybin alone. It puts it in this little mushroom box with a number of other things, maybe for a reason. So finally, somebody did some studies on what's the difference between psilocybin and psilocybin-containing mushrooms. And to nobody's surprise, mushrooms are different and more effective. So in a curious way, almost all of the published hard science research is on a less active, less a kind of inferior strain, so to speak, an inferior total kind of effect of psilocybin mushrooms. So in the microdose world, fortunately, synthetic psilocybin is almost unknown. So our research over the past, I guess now 12, 14 years, has been entirely with the more active substance called psilocybin-containing mushrooms. Now, I'm not sure we got the question there, but we've got an answer.
We certainly did. I've been wanting to ask you this because I don't think we covered it in our first conversation about your view of, we're both Americans, if you think that, at a baseline, it would behoove most people to dabble with microdosing in some capacity for all the reasons that you've explained during this conversation and our last one, or if it's generally your view that this is something that needs to be organically attractive to people, that it will have its time and place in general over time. Do you have a general sense of that? Obviously, this world is filled with problems that anyone who reads the newspapers can identify. What are your thoughts on how commonly used this stuff should be? You talked about it being a vitamin in some capacity, or more closely akin to a vitamin than anything else. How widespread do you think the dabbling, the use, the bespoke use of these substances probably should be in a healthy society?
Well, if we look at healthy societies, indigenous societies who've been stable and not making war on each other and not polluting each other's streams, and basically healthy, sane indigenous societies who use psychedelics. Most of them use microdoses, sometimes just for hunting. It improves your visual capacity, it fuels your stamina, sometimes in higher doses for spiritual purposes, sometimes just for healing. There's a group in Mexico that says, oh, you have a migraine. Here, just put a little mushroom under your tongue. Okay, goes away very quickly. So as a medicinal, the ayahuasca churches start giving ayahuasca to children 2 and 3 years old. So what we can say is, what's the question I ask about any substance is, what's the risk-benefit ratio, which is how much risk for how much benefit. Now, high doses have enormous benefits and real risks. That's why we make such an important distinction about setting, who is with you, what's the music, a lot of things to make it safer, because just on your own, it's not a great idea. Microdosing, because it has so few kind of effects that you would notice, is much safer. Psychedelics are incredibly safe substances compared to almost any pharmaceutical. However, microdoses are way, way safer than that. So how would it be if in your culture, you know, along with frosted Cheerios, they had, you know, you look down that list of ingredients and way down there is, you know, psilocybin mushrooms, probably not dangerous. Okay. But we are in a culture war, or in kind of a culture of history, where we have demonized some healing substances. And we've demonized them because perhaps at a very high dose, they should be restricted. They should be used carefully. In the cultures where obviously that's not an issue, there are no about taking mushrooms. And again, I'm thinking of the village in Mexico where the curandera, Maria Sabina, first introduced the West, in this case, a Wall Street banker and a photographer and somebody actually working with the CIA, who came to this village, and she introduced them to mushrooms, to psilocybin mushrooms at a high dose as a ritual. In that same village, and this is from a young anthropologist who was there a few years later, there's two ways into the village. One is a road and one is a very steep path. And the road, by now, because Westerners were basically appearing at this village and with no respect for the tradition or the people or anything else, so that literally it was blocked by police. So he was walking up this little, very steep path, and he was in good shape and he was athletic. And he noticed that passing him were two young men carrying loads of wood. And he looked at that and he said to them, you know, how do you do this? He says, well, we just take some of these little mushrooms. He said, where do you get them? He said, well, they're in the garden. So they were part of their normal cultural behavior. They were going to be stressing their bodies in a way that would be difficult. So how do they make it easier? They improve the functioning of the system. They improve your capacity to use the oxygen from breath. They improve the way the way your muscles use and use energy and use what you're giving to the muscles and so forth. That looks to me like a very healthy culture. So the question of could we put it into this culture, if we discovered it today and it wasn't linked to that terrible demon LSD, which makes your brains look like badly scrambled eggs, which, as we know, is just smart and wrong advertising, we wouldn't fuss about it. We would simply say, isn't that wonderful that there's a dietary supplement made from mushrooms that can be grown at home if people feel that they're too expensive? That would be very beneficial.
I would love to talk a little bit about what in your mind you think is happening in our culture. You talked about how some of the laws are getting a bit softer around these substances. And it's amazing, Jim, reading your biography, which I was reviewing, and I was reviewing some of the things we talked about in your first interview on the show about people you've known in your life. And you've been through the 60s and the backlash against the 60s and the Renaissance, which you've already noted. You know, this is obviously, nobody knows the future, but in your mind, where do you think culturally we might be going from here? I don't know if the resurgence of interest in psychedelics and in microdosing has surprised you over the last 10 or 15 years or so, but I'd love to just give you a little bit of time to talk about that, the history, but more importantly, the future and where you think or hope this might be going.
Well, if you'd asked me maybe 6-8 months ago, I would be more clearly optimistic because everything was going forward.
Yeah.
There was then an article in the New York Times where a researcher at Johns Hopkins basically spoke out against a senior researcher, Roland Griffiths, who had just recently died, and questioned his breakthrough research that really, what we would say, started the Renaissance. And the same article had nothing good to say about this detractor either. And it was a very unpleasant article, and not necessarily. It was a badly done and unfair to all parties. And I looked at it and I said, the backlash has started. And since then, there has been a growing number of articles questioning the validity of what we were accepting a year earlier, not with new data, but just questioning it. And recently, the MDMA, which was about to be approved of for use, a group of advisors to the Food and Drug Administration said, now that's like 7 years of research being trashed by people who had one thing in common. None of the people on that panel were clinicians. None of them had actually worked with people. So they basically said it doesn't meet the criteria of contemporary science. Mainly, one major area is the double-blind studies were not good. Now, the one thing that most people understand immediately when they're in a psychedelic research program is who's got the high dose and who's got the placebo. And there's this wonderful New Yorker cartoon where it's a waiting room. And people are sitting on the little couches and they're reading a magazine. And in one corner of the room, you see 4 or 5 nude people dancing madly. It's from a painting by Matisse. And a woman on the couch looks up and says, I think we're the placebo group. Okay. So what was happening at that moment is inappropriate science was being suggested that doesn't work. And they were saying, well, if you can't get the inappropriate science to work, then we can't approve the use of it. Now, that's kind of backwards, right? What it says is that the rules of science are first and the rules of reality are second. That's not a good sign. And however, that's only the United States. The rest of the world is moving ahead. Country after country is making things easier, both to do research and to do just to make it available, just to decriminalize or make things legal. So the thrust is still forward. But at least in the United States, we're going to go through, again, a high-dose backlash. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that microdoses continue to be quiet because, you know, if you've had a high dose of LSD, people actually can notice. And when you've had a correct dose of microdosing, all the people say is, God, you're really nice today. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, you're really nice too. And they will say that even if it isn't true. So that the world, so we're really dealing with two different realities. What's being now advised by people who are using, say, microdoses for overcoming addictions or just overcoming their prescriptions is if you want to make it safe and easy, grow your own. And there's wonderful groups out there that make what are called grow kits for home use, where literally you put it on the counter and you put some spores into it, which are legal to buy in 46 or 48 states. And then you watch. And when your mushrooms are big enough, you pull them out of this little container. So we're moving in two directions. the medical high dose, high capitalism areas are now suddenly getting some backlash. The natural low dose, microdose world seems to be just proliferating. I mean, I mentioned that there's this website with 250,000 people on it, all of whom are there just to share information. The site is very clear, and we've spent some time with the moderator of the site, a wonderful human being. No buying, no selling, no describing any company, nothing commercial, and don't use bad language.
Yeah. Is it your fear that we may be entering a backlash that could hypothetically lead to the kind of, you know, decades-long dark ages that I know you lived through in the 70s and 80s where all of the research stopped? Would you forecast that's likely to be happening? That's what you're seeing, or it's unclear?
It won't get that bad for a couple of reasons. Hmm. One is during the everything is illegal and nothing can be researched dark ages, underground chemists met people's needs. And one chemist, just one, Nicholas Sand, pointed out he'd personally made 250 million doses of LSD. Hmm. So there were clearly people who wanted it and who didn't care that it was illegal. No one probably listening remembers Prohibition, but Prohibition was that since alcohol was illegal, you had to buy it from criminals. And criminals said, this is a fantastic law. Mm-hmm. We love it. What shifted in the United States culturally is we moved from a beer and cider culture to a hard drinking culture. And I remember when I was in Paris, when I was about 20, and some of my French friends said, why do Americans get drunk at parties? And as I thought about it, it's because they had only been basically drinking hard liquor, and that the French drink hard liquor very, very seldom. And so they hadn't, and that being drunk was a socially acceptable behavior in the United States, particularly, say, in the college world. And it wasn't in older, more settled cultures like France. Hmm. So I think, so it's unlikely that we're going to get back to that. What will simply happen is that the medical uses under all kinds of restrictions will be delayed. But they will also be delayed mostly here in the United States. And as other countries continue to move forward, we will find once again kind of psychedelic travel. Right now, because certain things in the United States are simply expensive medically, you can go to Mexico, you can go to Thailand, you can go to lots of places and get the identical procedure from people trained from the identical medical schools for a quarter or a fifth or a sixth the price. Hmm. So there's some economics in there as well. Again, the microdose world being so hyper inexpensive, we haven't yet dealt with that. I mean, understand, if I'm depressed, and I've been depressed for like 18 years, I've tried 9 medications, I've been hospitalized once, I've tried electroshock. Okay, I'm called treatment resistant, which sounds like it's my fault, but it's not. What it means is the treatments you guys offered haven't helped. Okay. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this. Maybe I need more treatment.
I think maybe you were going to that. These
and
people.
The price, and you get psychedelic, you get into a psychedelic study or a clinic, and you are offered wonderful treatment. You're offered wonderfully trained people. You're offered maybe 1 or 2 sessions. You're offered a lot of psychotherapy before, during, and after. You're offered integration afterwards, and it works beautifully. It's very expensive. Hmm. Okay, so let's be thrifty and say $10,000, and we have fairly good evidence that the effects will last 3, 6, 9 months, maybe longer. We don't tend to measure much longer, but maybe longer. Here's an alternative: microdosing with a coach or without. You're getting the mushrooms off your kitchen table, or you're buying them from somebody. And the total cost for a month of microdosing, which would be about 10 different times, is about $15. Hmm. That's enough of a difference so that the lower cost and maybe less effective will be very much will remain regardless of what the very high dose and very expensive methods are. And the very expensive methods, by the way, once you get insurance, they'll get very popular. Remember, there's something called ketamine, which is very good for depression. And there's a version of it that Johnson & Johnson made that isn't quite as good. And it costs about, a dose of ketamine costs maybe $5. And a dose of this other costs about $700 plus being, you know, with professionals and overhead. Johnson & Johnson, as I recall, last year made sold enough of that stuff for like $700 million. So there's a huge market for helping depression. The inexpensive is a different world, and that's kind of the world I work in. So I don't, you know, it looks to me that that always eventually begins to take away from the high, the expensive market, especially when the substances, and again, we looked at psilocybin a while back, the psilocybin you get in a clinic is not as good as the psilocybin you get from picking it in the woods. And you know, organic food at the grocery store costs more because one is it's more, and two, people are willing to spend more to buy it. Psychedelics are moving in those directions.
I know, you know, on this show, I like to have a lot of conversations about health and well-being and counterintuitive ideas for how people might improve the quality of their life. And you just spoke at length about depression. And I wonder if we could spend a little bit more time having you talk about the kind of people with the kind of ailments that may be helped by trying some of these methodologies. And I know you've talked about depression, anxiety before. Who are the kind of people that you think might benefit from dipping their toe in these waters and trying out some of these substances?
Now, caution, this is going to be a small commercial.
Yeah.
Okay. My good friend Jordan Gruber and I have just completed a manuscript called Microdosing for Health, Healing, and Enhanced Performance. We published next February. In it, we have two categories of improvements. One is what healthy people do to exceed that kind of minimal health. And two is individual conditions, which we would call medical. And that ranges from eczema to Lyme disease. You just saw a little hearing aid fall down.
Yeah, it's okay.
I actually don't need it. To pain. We have a little section in the book of kind of, we want you to read this even if you don't want to read about all the other conditions because they don't refer to you. Depression, ADHD, and pain are three. Those are huge problems. The most common mental disease, or what we call a mental disease in the world, not just the US, is depression. And we all know the pandemic enormously increased that. ADHD, the number of prescriptions for ADHD in the United States has been growing very rapidly, especially for women. There's about 9 million people at least on prescriptions. These are both, and for depression and for ADHD, the medications are basically, don't worry, just take it for the rest of your life and it may work. The medications for depression work poorly. The medications for ADHD work pretty well, but they are somewhat addicting and they have a lot of side effects. So those are two huge areas. And then pain. These are, you know, and if we again look at the percentage of people who have some kind of pain at the moment, it's very large. And we all know that opiates are fabulous for reducing pain and equally fabulous for having terrible side effects, addiction, and so forth. So we've got massive areas of health with somewhat dicey medications. And when you dig a little deeper, as I did in this book, it's amazing how little we actually know about any of these conditions. It turns out the depression, which is the most common, The definition of depression is basically we don't have one. What people do, there's no physiological test, okay? No blood, no brain waves, nothing, okay? What people do when you go to your physician, you say, oh, I think I'm depressed. He says, well, I have a questionnaire. And the questionnaire has like 40 questions. And if you get a score of, 20 or 18, whatever it is, you're that depressed. And if you get 36 questions, you're more depressed. Mm-hmm. So the only instrument we're using to measure depression is human beings. Well, okay, that's pretty good. There's a test of questions. Well, actually, there's a number of those instruments. There's 7 that are popular. And then the question is, well, it's the same condition. Why do we need 7 different instruments? Well, we measure somewhat different things. Well, what do we measure in common? And this was, I just didn't know how to deal with this, which is there's one question that appears on all 7 scales. One single question. You ready? Mm. Are you sad? Okay. And the answer actually, if you understand the subtleties, is a better question is, are you depressed? That turns out to be the diagnostic tool to measure the world's most kind of widespread condition. Okay. So depression is, something like being depressed. That's what depression is. Thank you very much. You know, what is an apple? Well, it's very apple-like. No, that doesn't count. Okay. But it counts in medicine. So what we have is a theory of what causes depression. It's actually called a hypothesis. A hypothesis is a classy term, even classier term than theory, for the word guess. Hmm. It's supposed to be a particular brain chemical. I say supposed to, and I'm not going to go into it because the data, according to the latest research, is the hypothesis, which we've had for 40 years, it never became accepted, is wrong. It's not serotonin. Okay? It's a little bit, as someone wrote very well, is if you have a headache and you take an aspirin, the headache goes away. Therefore, aspirin is a good medication for headache. But you don't have a headache because you have a lack of aspirin. Mm. Okay? So the medications, which work often like 30, 40% of the time for most people, we don't know quite how they work. So then let's go to high-dose psychedelics. They have a success rate with the high doses and the people and the expense, but they have a very high success rate, like 80% of people have amazing improvement right then and there. And that improvement lasts a certain amount of time, at least a few months for most people. Okay. Then let's look at microdosing. And we have one study where there were people basically, as we ran it, were calling, writing in and saying, what do I do? And we would say, what do you want to take it for? And here's what you do. And take a test every day of your moods, positive and negative. And then at the end of 30 days, write us whatever we obviously didn't ask. So we had, 700-800 people, half of them depression. About 80%, similar to high dose, reported the depressions went away. A number of people said the depressions went away within 1 or 2 doses. And the response was, what the comment was, and it's very common, I felt like myself again, meaning they felt like they did before they became depressed. Now, because they're taking microdosings over a certain amount of time, we don't know how long that effect lasts. But we do know in microdosing, you take it for a month or 6 weeks, and then you take several weeks or months off. And independently around the world, various groups that began working with microdoses came up with that was a good idea. That may allow the brain-body system to take over and basically make use of the healing, just as, if you're on crutches, the goal is to not get on better and better crutches.
Yeah.
The goal is to someday get the crutches off so that you work the muscles again and restore and repair. So here we have 2 systems with psychedelics, both of which are considerably better than the medications, which are the best-selling medications on the planet. So there's a lot of room for psychedelics to improve people's lives. And what our book does is it basically says, here are the basics, here's the substances, here they're how they're used, here's the concerns, here's the legality, et cetera. And now let's look at this condition of depression. And then here's, I think, 10 or 12 cases that we have under depression. It's a major area. where people report, not on a numerical scale, but report how, oh, I cleaned my house and I enjoyed it. Okay. I am having fun with the children again. My job is still incredibly boring, but I don't mind. So that's what we're seeing. And that's just one situation. ADHD is different, but we have the same certain set of problems that the medications help with, but the side effects are tough. And again, we have millions of people doing this. Pain actually is different. One is, you'll never guess what we use to measure pain. Okay. Yes, you will guess. Yes. How much does it hurt? And does it still hurt when I do that? And the answer is yes. Okay. That's a sore spot. Yes. Okay. So what do we take for pain? We've got a huge number of things, you know, from aspirin to heroin. And they all alleviate pain in some way, and we don't quite understand it. What happens with psychedelics? Not clear, because it's not studied much high dose, but microdoses, it's very, very important. And what people report is one of two possibilities. One is the pain is at the same level, and the other is the pain goes down. Okay? There are two groups. Let's talk about these people because it's more obvious. It hurts less. I was a 4, and when I'm microdosing, I'm a 1. Okay, it feels better. I'm not hurting as much. Side effects, none. Addiction, none. Can I go off for a few days? Yes, and maybe the pain returns, maybe it doesn't. Okay. This group says my pain is a 7. I have had a car accident, and all the rehabilitation got me so I can function, but I'm in pain. They report that the pain is the same, but their identification with it has shifted. So there's a difference between I'm in pain, or my hip hurts, or when I walk, my feet hurt. That's very different. That's a lack of it. That you don't identify as pain. You identify as a person with a lot of systems, most of which are not in pain. So that the pain is at more of a distance. It may not be improving in a numerical sense, but it's improving in that way. And that's that we have, since we're not able or interested in theory, we don't know what the differences are. We do know a difference, by the way, with depression. Some people take microdosing for depression for 4, 6, 8 weeks, and then they stop. And why do they stop? They say, well, I'm not depressed. We have another group who seem to be quite similar, who take it for 4, 6, 8 weeks, and they stop. Because that's the way you work with microdosing. But they say, oh, the depression is returning. And so they go back and do another course of microdosing. Now, we don't have good data, but we have this particular possibility, which has a certain amount of common sense. Just this group's life is working all right. This group's life is not working all right. So their life has built-in stresses, built-in, you know, kind of dangers and built-in loneliness or whatever it is, but their life isn't working and their depression is more likely to return. Now, in a common sense way, it makes sense. Just as if I'm taking aspirin for a headache, if I have a headache every day, I might take an aspirin every day. If I take an aspirin, the headache goes away and it doesn't come back, obviously I don't. So that's the kind of data we're looking at is, and we're now at that second level. One is, do microdoses help with depression? Yes, in most cases. Forever? No. Some yes, some no. So that's the next level of research, which is a wonderful place to be, because then you're really fine-tuning. So you can begin to say to people, you know, it looks like if you microdose, it's likely that within 6 or 8 weeks, you'll be fine, because you're going to find your depression alleviates in the first week. For you, 6 or 8 weeks, you'll probably be fine, but watch carefully how you feel, because you may be prone to either a return of depression from external events, which we can see and understand, or internal chemistry that we really don't understand at all.
Fascinating. And Jim, I would love, if we can find the time when the book comes out, to have you back on and talk about it in more detail. And I know we're getting close to the end of our time together, and If you need to keep this short, I get it. But I wanted to close with asking you about a little bit about your life and how these substances have affected you, both in your development as a person and also, and I don't think I've read this anywhere, your spiritual or religious views. In any detail you would like to share, I'd love to maybe close on that.
But one of the reasons you haven't read about it is I don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't talk about it because my use of psychedelics has very little to do with the way the universe works. Mm. I'm not a psychonaut, okay? I'm awkward about that because I don't want people to know that I haven't used as much as all kinds of other people have used. So when you say, what are the differences in mushroom species? I don't know. Mm. Okay, if you say, well, you know, when you compare ayahuasca in the Shibibo in the Amazon, how does that compare when you were in Africa taking ibogaine with a B-tweet? And the answer is, I haven't done those. Mm. I ended up in the microdose world, maybe because it's very safe and it's very fascinating. It's very boring and it's more likely to change the culture in a beneficial way than anything else I've ever done. The reason being is, this is a comment from Paul Stamets, people who take psilocybin mushrooms are nicer. Now, it sounds kind of silly and trivial and, you know, cool hippie thing, but imagine a world in which people were discernibly nicer, okay? I know it's hard to imagine, but just go for it.
Yeah.
Okay. We also know, for example, that if you spend a certain amount of time in nature every day, you're nicer. You're healthier, partly because you were designed to live in nature. So you're simply becoming more, the way human beings have been, you know, until the last couple hundred years when they could live indoors. Hmm. So my own spiritual beliefs haven't changed since I had a very high dose of psychedelics in 1961. I know for some of you, that's like, was that near the end of the Civil War? Yeah, maybe. But I had a realization of my own kind of being part of the natural world and that my own personality was not all that central to who I was. And it's made life much more interesting and much less disturbing when it gets difficult. Mm. So I have never recommended anyone take a psychedelic. I have recommended endlessly that you look at the evidence and make your own decision. Now, it's pretty clear where I think the evidence will lead you, but that's an opinion, and it's your body, and it's your mind, and it's your future. And you're the only one who can make those decisions. And Alexander Shulgin had a wonderful thing. He made a chemical, and he looked at it, and he thought, nobody in the universe has ever seen this chemical. And then he thought about how he was going to put it in his mouth. And he thought, you should never put anything in your mouth that you don't understand. And I thought, whoa, that just solved a whole lot of, you know, legal and moral and ethical questions. And so that you get the best information you can and you do the best you can. And you try, if you have a choice, go for the safe one first. Mm. With microdoses, start a little too low so you don't have any effect. That's perfect. And then if you move it up, you'll find where the sweet spot is. You don't start by saying, how much can I take and get away with it? That leads to problems. So I have a very kind of very uninteresting personal spiritual philosophy, which is nature kind of set it up so that if we pay attention, we do better than we've been doing. And nature has also offered us a lot of reminders that you can pick and eat.
Beautiful. It was so good to see you again. And I can't wait for the book to come out. And I just want to say thank you again for giving me the time and the audience that I'm sure will be in high numbers that will listen and watch this this interview. So Jim, thank you so much for doing this.
Well, it's really a pleasure. I is one of, you know, I do a number of podcasts for people, but this is one that there's a feeling of, again, kindness and wisdom and support that I'm really happy to be back. And yes, when the book comes out and I am touting it and holding it up with the cover and doing things like that. I'll see if we can do an interview that doesn't sound like that. Okay?
That's a deal. That means so much. I really appreciate it, Jim.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.